diplomacy in the Middle East.
Biden's team has been coordinating with the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump as Biden's envoy, Amos Hochstein, continued their diplomatic push in the region.
The latest from Los Angeles.
These fires are different. They are larger, more destructive. Again, there are multiple fires at once that have destroyed thousands of structures, that have really destroyed certain communities, the Palisades and Altadena.
And what voters are looking for after Donald Trump takes office.
I would like to see him definitely take control of the border and our illegal immigrant situation.
Today is Monday, January 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. With just a week to go before U.S. President Joe Biden leaves office, his aides are working with President-elect Donald Trump's team in a last-ditch push for a ceasefire in Gaza. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wita-Kuswara has our story.
Death and destruction continue to be a daily reality for Palestinians in Gaza, despite the United States pushing for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas before President Joe Biden leaves office on January 20th.
We're seeing some progress. And, you know, I know hope springs eternal, but I think I'm still hopeful that we'll be able to have a prisoner exchange. Hamas is the one getting in the way of that exchange right now. But I think we may be able to get that done. We need to get it done.
Biden's team has been coordinating with the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump as Biden's envoy, Amos Hochstein, continued their diplomatic push in the region. Trump this week sent his Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, for talks with Qatari officials who are interlocutors for Hamas.
I actually believe that we're working in tandem in a really good way, but it's the president, his reputation, the things that he has said, that are driving this negotiation.
Earlier this week, Trump repeated his ultimatum for a deal that would release Israeli hostages held by Hamas.
If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East.
Analysts say Trump's demand is unlikely to move Hamas, as the U.S.-designated terror group is already being pummeled by Israel's military campaign, and is unlikely to impact outstanding issues on the negotiation table, said Aaron David Miller, former U.S. Middle East negotiator and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace via Skype.
Numbers of prisoners to be released, how many hostages, what about proof of life, where are the living hostages, how many are going to return in phase one? These are issues that have very little to do with incoming Trump administration politics.
On Thursday, Biden welcomed the Lebanese parliament's election of Joseph Aoun as the country's next president, ending a years-long power vacuum that saw a 14-month war between Israel and Hezbollah. Patsy Wita-Kuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Sticking with Middle East diplomacy, Sunday in Riyadh, Syria's new foreign minister met with other regional diplomats. It's the first such meeting since Bashar al-Assad's regime fell. Reuters' Sierra Lee has our story.
Foreign ministers and top diplomats from Western and Middle Eastern countries met with Syria's new foreign minister on Sunday, held in the Saudi capital Riyadh. It was the first such regional gathering on Syria since President Bashar al-Assad was ousted last month. In attendance were ministers from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, as well as representatives from Bahrain, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey. Envoys were also present from the European Union and the United States. The meeting was the first to include both Syria's new rulers and top Western officials, and was led by Saudi Arabia. It follows a meeting of top diplomats from the US, UK, France, Germany and the EU held on Syria in Rome on Thursday. Some regional players have previously signalled concerns over Syria's new Islamist rulers and what they need to do to get international recognition.
Sierra Lee of Reuters reporting for us. And more news from the Middle East. The death toll in Gaza as a result of Israel's war with Hamas may be higher than Hamas's own official figures. VOA's Henry Ridgewell explains.
More than 64,000 deaths in the Gaza Strip caused by violence. A new study in the medical journal The Lancet says the Hamas-run Ministry of Health underreported the death toll by more than 40% between October 7th, 2023 and June 30th, 2024. report co-author Zeyna Jamaluddin of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
In reality, the number of mortality might be higher if we also include the issue of not accessing healthcare, heart attacks, and some of that aspect. Infectious diseases, maternal care, not pregnant women not being able to get access to proper delivery, and so on.
59% of the dead were women, children, and older people, according to the peer-reviewed Lancet report, roughly in line with other estimates. It did not identify the number of Hamas fighters among the dead. In a statement, Israel's embassy in London told VOA, quote, "Any information that derives from Gaza cannot be trusted, nor can you ignore the Lancet's history of anti-Israel bias. VOA is unable to verify the figures as Israel does not allow journalists into Gaza." The researchers cross-referenced three different sources or lists, the Gaza Ministry of Health, an online survey of reported deaths, and obituaries on social media, Jamaluddin says.
It's important so that within each list we don't have duplication, so we don't want to have the same person within the same list, listed multiple times, so we do a lot of cleaning. But then we link all of the three lists together.
The same technique has been used to estimate deaths in other conflicts, she adds.
It has been used in Sudan, in Yemen, has also been used in Kosovo, and some of these evidence has been used in the ICJ.
Israel launched its war on Hamas in Gaza following the militant group's cross-border attack on October 7, 2023, which killed more than 1,200 people, mostly civilians. The United States, United Kingdom, European Union and others have designated Hamas as a terror organization. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Changing gears now, we follow up on the fires ravaging Los Angeles. Joining me on the phone is Kevin Rector of the LA Times.
There are still, you know, a number of fires burning. There's been more than 12,000 structures destroyed or damaged. The death toll continues to climb. The last I saw it, it was at 16. And officials believe that the devastation and our understanding of it is going to continue to increase. They are still making their way into some of these areas, and again, the fires are still burning.
Has there been any progress into determining a cause of the fire?
That is something that officials are also looking to do, and there is a lot of speculation out there as to what has caused these fires. There's not necessarily the same cause for each of the different fires. There is some speculation that utilities or power lines may be involved. There has been some concern about whether there is any arson involved. There is concern about embers from maybe old fires being reignited by the really powerful Santa Ana winds that are coming through the region. Officials say that it is just too early to determine cause or origin of these fires. Oftentimes, those investigations will take months. I spoke to someone from the ATF, which is in charge of investigating the Palisades fire, and she stressed again that these investigations are incredibly complex. They are going into regions that have been burned to the ground, and so evidence is difficult to collect. But there's a lot of expertise in fire investigations, and they will be looking to determine cause and origin over time.
One of the things I thought was very interesting about one of your recent articles was you talked about a recent interview with Craig Fugate, who used to run FEMA in the Obama administration. And he compared these fires in Los Angeles, to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, not as a not comparable on the scope of destruction, but comparable in that they will become cultural touchstones for the city. Can you kind of get into that with me? Tell me what he was talking about, what this means now for the future of Los Angeles.
Yeah, he has a lot of experience with disasters, and there are certain types of disasters that reach a certain scale, reach so many people in a community
wipe out communities and, you know, in what feels like a blink of an eye, that become these historical moments for residents who over time look back to those events and consider their city as existing in one reality before and another reality after. And it was Fugate's estimate that these fires will be one of those touchstones for LA. There are a lot of people throughout LA, longtime LA natives, who say these fires are different. They are larger, more destructive. Again, there are multiple fires at once that have destroyed thousands of structures, that have really destroyed certain communities, the Palisades and Altadena. And moving forward, the recovery from fires of this scale will be years in the making. And so the idea Fugate was sharing was that, again, over time, people in LA will look to these fires as a marker of massive changes in the city, many of which we still have yet to see and will come to fruition again over many months and years.
So sort of the same way New Yorkers might feel about September 11th, where how life was very different before than after.
Yeah, and for some, even, you know, Superstorm Sandy, there are natural disasters, there are terrorist acts and other events that are also touchstones, but there are a lot of big natural disasters that changed the landscape of cities forever, and Katrina was one on a huge, unfathomable scale. And these fires are large enough that they are going to have that impact for LA, at least in the estimation of Mr. Fugate.
We'll leave it there for today. Kevin Rector writes for the Los Angeles Times. Mr. Rector, thanks so much for your reporting. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. On Sunday, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Malala Yousafzai urged Muslim leaders not to legitimize Afghanistan's ruling Taliban, accusing them of being the perpetrators of gender apartheid and calling for accountability. Yousafzai spoke in Pakistan at the closing session of an international summit on girls' education in Muslim communities, sharply criticizing the hardline Taliban government for imposing sweeping curbs on Afghan women's access to education and employment. Human metapneumovirus, or HMPV, has recently spread widely across China, overwhelming hospitals and evoking memories of the COVID-19 outbreak. HMPV is not new, it has been known for years, and typically has a low mortality rate. Nevertheless, epidemiologists are calling for greater transparency about the spread of the virus to help contain infections. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said Sunday she expected good relations marked by dialogue with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump when he returns to the White House in a week. In a speech to mark her first 100 days in office, Mexico's first female president stressed that her country was free, independent, and sovereign. Sheinbaum's early days in office have been dominated by a war of words with Trump. Her mix of firmness and diplomacy in the face of his attacks have boosted her popularity in Mexico. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. And speaking of Donald Trump, he'll become the 47th president of the United States next week. American voters have differing expectations for their next president. VOA's Scott Stearns has the story.
In the southern state of Mississippi, expectations for Donald Trump's second presidency are mixed. Bobby Joe Harrell voted for Trump.
I would like to see him definitely take control of the border and our illegal immigrant situations. I'm all about helping anyone that I can, especially where young children are concerned. But I'd also like to see my children and my grandchildren be able to enjoy the America that I grew up in.
Transgender New Yorker Angelo Meyer is concerned about the future under an administration that has expressed opposition to gender-affirming health care.
Republicans watching need to know investing in trans kids is just as important as investing in their own kids. Because we are the next generation who's going to lead this country. And we have bright ideas, strong futures.
Sean Cushing wants Trump to focus on the economy.
Just stick to the campaign promises and end the taxes on tips the way he said he would.
Jerry Helton in Mississippi agrees the economy is the top priority.
I would like for President Trump to be able to lower the cost of living for us again. I'm tired of living from paycheck to paycheck.
In Pennsylvania, Samira Sharfawi worries about Trump's impact on her reproductive and religious rights.
I'm thinking I'm losing my right, women rights. I'm thinking I'm losing my right religion because I see that he wants to put forward just Christianity, and I believe that this country opens up to every religion. I feel as though that everyone should be able to learn about the religion in schools, not just one.
In Texas, Trump supporter Ross Barrera says the incoming president's business experience will help put the country right.
People are tired. What people want here, they want jobs. They want a good economy. They want the inflation to go down. They want border security. They want oil and fuel.
The most important thing Trump can do for Mississippi voter Yael Frausto is to lay out a clear agenda.
I would want him to be straightforward about the policies that he is going to put forward into the country, just so we know, everyone in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, what we have to look forward to or not look forward to in the next 4 years.
Trump will be sworn in as president in Washington January 20th. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Meanwhile, on Sunday, President-elect Trump's incoming National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, told the ABC News program This Week that he expects Trump to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin regarding the war in Ukraine.
Well, we haven't set the exact framework for it yet. We're working on that. But I do expect a call for at least in the coming days and weeks. So that would be a step. We we'll take it from there.
This as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called on allies Sunday to honor all promises to supply Ukraine with weapons, including those to counter Russian air attacks. At the same time, Zelensky said Sunday in a post on X that Kyiv is ready to hand over North Korean prisoners of war to their leader Kim Jong-un if he can organize their exchange for Ukrainians held captive in Russia. Zelensky posted a short video showing the interrogation of two men who are presented as North Korean soldiers. One of the men said through an interpreter that he did not know he was fighting against Ukraine and had been told he was on a training exercise. Perhaps trolling North Korean leadership, Zelensky said that for those North Korean soldiers who did not wish to return home, there may be other options available. As we've reported here before, France starts 2025 with a further drawdown of its military presence in its former African colonies, and fresh tensions ignited this week with controversial remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron. So, what does it mean for French influence in Africa moving forward? Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Following Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, Chad, Senegal, and now ally Ivory Coast have asked France to withdraw its troops from their soil. The reasons vary, from growing anti-French sentiment to calls for greater sovereignty and strengthening ties with other foreign powers. But the impact is the same.
There is a clear collapse of French policy in Africa.
Thierry Virgoulon is a researcher at the French Institute for International Relations, Africa Center.
Of course, the withdrawal of the French troops and basically the end of the French military presence in Africa is a symbol of that collapse.
French-Africa relations haven't improved in recent days. On Monday, President Emmanuel Macron suggested some Sahel countries had forgotten to say thank you to French troops for spearheading a decade-long fight against Islamist insurgencies. That drew sharp criticism from leaders in Chad and Senegal. French authorities say Macron's remarks were taken out of context. Jean-Pierre Molny is director of the French Institute for International and Strategic Affairs think tank. He believes France needs to be less focused on the immediate fallout and instead concentrate on longer-term ties with Francophone African countries that are today rejecting Paris. He says France should think more about development and sharing the future of Africa's security and less about adopting a big brother attitude. Macron's government announced plans last year to reduce its military presence on the continent, where it also has troops in Gabon and Djibouti, and make it more responsive to countries' demands. France has also expanded ties beyond Francophone Africa. Its two biggest trading partners, for example, are now Nigeria and South Africa. But analyst Pierre Coulon, for one, predicts France's long-term influence in Africa will remain limited, at best.
There's very little that the French government can do at the moment, and this is very much playing in favor of Russia and other countries that are not Western.
He believes France's strategic priorities will also shift to potential conflicts in Europe. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
Last week, on Tuesday, the U.S. said that Sudan's rapid support forces are committing genocide. Henry Wilkins brings us reaction from experts and rights advocates.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a January 7th statement that Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, and allied militias have systemically murdered men and boys, even infants, on an ethnic basis. Determining that crimes committed by RSF and its allies amount to genocide. The leaders of a Darfuri advocacy group reacted to the news. Adam Rojal is with the General Coordination of Darfur Displaced People and Refugees.
The community in Darfur is well aware of the crimes and violations committed against them. They consider these acts of genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and crimes against humanity to be a natural part of their lives. For them, the recognition and acknowledgement by the international community and larger countries is a victory and a step towards achieving justice.
The RSF and its associated militias are mostly ethnic Arabs, victimizing black Sudanese, particularly the ethnic Masalit people. The declaration is a first step towards justice, say rights groups. Nicole Windersheim, a deputy director at Human Rights Watch.
They can feel that their trauma is recognized. I mean, I don't want to understate that.
Blinken also announced sanctions against RSF's leader and businesses linked to the paramilitary group. Windersheim says this is the second time in 20 years that genocide has been declared in Darfur.
Lessons unlearned and not enough preventative action.
Many consider genocide to be the most serious crime under international law. Cameron Hudson of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the legal implications are significant.
Significant from a legal perspective, but I think also from a moral perspective.
Blinken singled out RSF commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglo for violating commitments under international law to protect Sudanese civilians. One leader accused in the 2004 genocide in Darfur is still on trial at the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, Rojal says ethnic killings continue and that ongoing fighting in parts of Darfur has led to famine.
Direct killing inside the camps, in the cities and neighborhoods, and starvation, famine, and hunger, these all continue.
When asked for a response to the accusations, an RSF spokesperson provided VOA with a statement widely shared on social media. It said, "This decision has no value or impact on the current situation in Sudan, but may complicate the Sudanese crisis. The statement does not deny the allegation of genocide." Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.